Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
It was May 1987 when I first fell in love. I was 11 and a half, he was three times my age, and singing for his life on a stage in Belgium. Johnny Logan, Hold Me Now. As soon as he opened his mouth, there was no way I could, as the song says, close my heart to how I was feeling. As Johnny moved smoothly through those key changes to that emotional crescendo, one little girl in Bob Riggan would never be the same. I didn't understand what it was that made me feel sick as I crouched behind the couch, too terrified to watch the votes of the juries come in. As the Irland 12 points started to rack up, my little heart dared to hope. Could Johnny, who'd already won the Eurovision in 1980, really do it again? Of course he could, and he did, and when Johnny rounded off his victory performance with the words, "I love you, Ireland," I knew I wanted to marry him. But it wasn't just the white suit and the oh-so-handsome baby face, or even the little streak of blonde at the back of his dark head of hair. It was how he made me feel. An unfamiliar, warm and fuzzy glow. I felt proud to be Irish. I lay in my bedroom rewinding the tape over and over until I'd learned the song by heart. I practiced for hours, singing into a hairbrush and gazing up at his poster. I earned great kudos with the Spanish students that summer because I knew all the words. They loved him too, but Johnny was Irish, so I had a special claim on him. Growing up in the 80s, I'd always felt a little bit inferior to the kids from Fame, the Why Don't You gang, and those beautiful Spanish students. There was the dole queue that stretched past the library and around the corner onto High Street. Older brothers and sisters of my classmates getting the boat to England. Bombs going off in Belfast. We needed a lift to be good at something. And that day in May, Johnny gave us a little flicker of hope. It later lit to a flame when Stephen Roach won the Tour de France and Ray Houghton put the ball in the English net. Then came Italia 90. After that, a hat-trick of Eurovision wins. We were on a roll and once again it was Johnny that scored the first goal. In 1992, Linda Martin sang his song, Why Me? As Johnny hugged her on that stage in Sweden, my 16-year-old heart pounded and I thought, why her, indeed? Johnny disappeared to somewhere in Europe, but I kept singing his song, all the time hoping that maybe one day he would hold me now. The hairbrush was swapped for a beer bottle. Now I performed at back garden barbecues, bars in Brooklyn, the back seats of taxis, and the bow of a boat on Lake Constance. I even sang it at the 1999 New York heat of the Rose of Tralee. I wasn't a contestant, but it felt like a party piece that needed to be shared. People always sang along, and not just to drown out my terrible voice, but I think because it transported them back to a time when we Irish were finally given permission to be delighted with ourselves. But not everyone got it. I remember giving it gusto once at a Belfast lock-in, only to be met with a stunned silence when I finished with Johnny's immortal words, "I love you, Ireland." They weren't quite there yet, I thought. Then one night at a house party, a guy came up to me and said, "You know, my dad's Johnny's manager. I can give him a ring." Next thing, Johnny was saying hello to me over the phone from his hotel room in Turkey. I didn't believe it was him, so I started asking trick questions like, "What's your real name?" Sean Sherrard answered them all. When I told him I had tickets for his homecoming gig, he invited me to sing with him on stage. But I was, at that moment, afraid the dream wasn't real. And I found myself saying, "Johnny, I don't do duets." But then I wondered, what if? That Vicar Street show was his first in Ireland in 13 years. Security was light. But when Johnny came out in his tight silver trousers, the crowd went wild and stormed the stage. Bouncers swarmed in from the wings. I didn't dare demand my duet. I told myself it was fear of provoking the mob of middle-aged women, but really I wasn't sure I'd be able to find the voice that had roared out the words over all of those years, just longing for this special moment. So I stayed in my seat when he sang Hold Me Now. Twice. Not crashing the stage that night is the biggest regret of my life. But by the time the next gig came around, I was ready. I got to the front and Johnny grabbed my hand. I wanted him to hold on forever. It's been 40 years since Johnny's first Eurovision win with What's Another Year? And this year's another that's not going well. I'd high hopes that A Girl from Balbriggan would win back our past Euro glory, but the contest was cancelled and we're all in lockdown, going a little bit mad. In May 2020, I'm still a bit in love, and as the song goes, time has been kind since we're apart. Now I'm 44 and a half, so I'm catching up with Johnny, who just turned 66. Happy birthday, Johnny. I love you, Ireland. I love you, Johnny.
Mesdames et messieurs, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for spending this wonderful night with us, and maybe see you soon. Meine Damen und Herren, guten Abend und vielleicht bis bald. Malheureusement, c'est la fin. Nous avons passé un merveilleux moment avec vous. Merci mille fois et au revoir.
So our thanks too to Victor Laszlo, who did a splendid job of Com Air, sang very prettily at the beginning of this contest, which has been won by Ireland and Johnny Logan.
I still love you, Ireland. Don't close your heart to how you feel. Dream. Don't be afraid the dream's not real. Close your eyes. Pretend it's just the two of us again. Make believe this moment's here to stay.
For 70 years he kept it. A pebble, tiny and slightly misshapen. I was just a young child when I first noticed it, in the corner of the narrow windowsill in the garage. Just resting there, close to his workbench, touching distance away. Not framed or given any particular pride of place, just there. For all those years, a symbol of remembrance. He only had to glance at it, or pick it up and gently roll it around in his fingers, and he was back there again. Back in the cauldron of war in the North African desert. And back specifically to one time and one place. May 1945, Tripoli. Back to that Libyan city and to the Mediterranean washed beach where he had knelt down that day, picked up the pebble and stuffed it deep into the pocket of his khaki shorts. Why? As a keepsake, to commemorate the day that was in it. The day when he knew for sure that it was over, that the war in Europe was won, that soon he would be making his way home to Coleraine and into the arms of his bride, the girl he had come home from the war to marry 2 days before Christmas in 1942. So on that 8th of May in 1945, on what became known as Victory in Europe Day, when he found himself on that Libyan beach, full of joy and relief at the news of the German surrender, he picked up his talisman pebble, knowing that soon he would see his young wife again. My father was just 24 years old that day in Tripoli, a young man who would be lucky enough to see 70 more summers, and all of them with Marion, my mother, by his side. But despite his long life, he never forgot his days in the desert, nor did he ever lose his affection for the people who inhabit that part of the world. From Egypt and Libya to Jordan, Gaza and the West Bank, all his life he retained a deeply held grow for the Arab world and passed it on to me. Wahid, Inan, Talata, Aruba, Hamsa, Sita, Sebwa, Temanya, Tisa, Ashra. I was 6 or 7 years of age when my father taught me that, to count from 1 to 10 in Arabic. I can still rattle it off, mantra-like at the drop of a hat, my still childhood pronunciation not quite received Arabic, but hopefully not too far off the mark. My childhood was peppered with my father's desert stories. How camels were not to be trusted, an opinion he'd formed after witnessing a young Arab boy being viciously bitten on the head, the boy almost losing his life from the attack. Or the day he was ordered to shoot his own beloved dog, a wolf, if truth be told, that he had rescued as a pup. Now, with a major military move underway, the dog couldn't accompany him. So worried was my father that the dog might suffer, he spared no bullets when it came to dispatching him. Then that night, he was approached by one of his commanding officers. "I believe," he quipped to my heartbroken father, "your poor dog died of lead poisoning today." I can still hear my father's laugh telling that story. Then there was the time he was hitching a lift back up the desert after a couple of days R&R in Cairo. On the outskirts of the city, in the boiling heat and with his thumb in the air, suddenly a truck screeched to a halt. "Is that you, young Jim?" came the Northern Irish voice from the open-top vehicle. And my father scrambled gratefully on board to be greeted by a fellow Coleraine man. My father, Jim Lighton, was a dispatch rider with the RAF, and what a dash he cuts in all those old photographs. A handsome young man in khakis, astride a Norton motorbike, or standing at the door of his tent, his skin burnished by the African sun. Some dispatch missions were straightforward, others were dangerous. I never heard about those, though, because apart from my father's yarns, all light-hearted and self-deprecating, he didn't talk about the actual war. Not about the horror, not about the fear, or the sacrifice, or the loss. Only once, across the breakfast table some years ago, my mother talking casually about the time he wrote to tell her there would be no letters for a while because they were going on a special mission. Only that once did Jim's war mask ever slip. "What was that about?" I asked, meaning the special mission. A cloud crossed my father's face and he fell silent, trying to gather himself, to rearrange his emotions. He attempted to speak. The words wouldn't come. Tears welled in his eyes. And then, slowly, he stood up, pushed back his chair, and walked from the room. He was 84 years of age at the time, 6 decades and a lifetime away from the cauldron of war. But it was still there, the searing memory of whatever happened on that mission. The horror, the fear, the sacrifice, and the loss. And although he lived for another decade, and we never wandered into war darkness territory again, I like to think that my father kept that Libyan beach pebble in memory not only of what had been won on that May Day in Tripoli, but also in remembrance of all that had been lost. And I hope, whenever he picked up that tiny pebble over the years, that it was the happy memories that filled his mind. The beauty of the sunrise over the sands, the camaraderie of being brothers in arms, the euphoria of that day in Tripoli. And I hope too that those memories were enough to keep the darkness at bay.
There were only a couple of them, but I still felt a bit of trepidation as I took them out for the first time in many years. Partly because we're all feeling things a little more intensely at the moment, or a lot more. And I knew that if I opened these boxes, some feelings were bound to fly out. I wasn't unfamiliar with their contents, or so I thought. But The spice drawers had been labelled, rationalised and rearranged. The storage under the stairs had been emptied into the kitchen and carefully packed away again. And I certainly wasn't going to start kidding myself that I'm the kind of person that alphabetizes their books. Not yet, anyway. I opened the first box. There's an awful lot of tat in there. Lots and lots of keepsakes and tchotchkes. Earrings from when I used to wear earrings. And badges from when I used to wear badges. Including one that said in large, bold lettering, I lasted 24 hours. Proof. I'd gone the distance at the Project Art Centre's 24-hour punk festival in the late 70s. And another badge, taken from the caved-in radiator grill of the Golf GTI I nearly killed myself in sometime in the early 90s. I've slowed down quite a bit since then. There were treasured ticket stubs aplenty. But really, what are the chances of my future grandchildren being impressed at the ticket from the only Irish gig that Bill Hicks ever played? Bill who? They certainly could care less that Grandpops was given a backstage pass to the Eurovision in 1988 in order to photograph the winner, Celine Dion, who... There are plenty of other memory-jogging documents in the boxes. Long-forgotten membership cards, cancelled passports with stamps from countries that no longer exist, and a receipt from the time I was so broke I had to sell a litre of blood in Berlin. Good times. But I knew that these things were just asides to what I'd really hung on to down all these years. The real motherlode was the letters, the notes, and the cards, including a few fairly wicked caricatures of me drawn on homemade Father's Day cards by my son, a gifted and merciless cartoonist from a very early age. I took some photographs of them and sent them to brighten up his lockdown in Montreal. There are all kinds of letters, several of which I had no memory of ever receiving, such as the airmail letter I was sent in my late teens by my friend Brian, which arrived in Morocco where I'd gone to work as a surveyor for a while, rather than finishing school, much to the despair of my mother. Brian's letter included a detailed plan that involved him writing great screenplays that I would then film, and how we would then go on to make our fortunes together. At the time, I was still learning how to work a stills camera, and the thought of making films was beyond my wildest dreams. Nevertheless, Brian proved to be right. We both did end up in careers as a screenwriter and a director. But we've yet to make a film together. And even more unfortunately, neither of us has yet arrived at the making a fortune level either. But of course, what really tipped me over the edge were the love letters. Letters signed with love, lots of love, with all my love. Some sent by people that I've shamefully little memory of ever being loved by. Seen in rapid succession, they were a concentrated documentation of love sent, received, and lost. Someone wiser than me once pointed out that all love stories end in tragedy, of one kind or another, and some of these letters were evidence of the heartbreaking moments just before the inevitable end. Mind you, the ones that meant the most to me weren't any multi-page protestations of undying passion, but the ones like the couple of tiny notes left where the sender knew I'd find them, and my heart would unexpectedly be blown open by the knowledge that I was so loved. I already knew all of these. I've carried most of them inside me since the time they were sent. I didn't really need the evidence. But there was something new to be discovered in these boxes. Something I hadn't properly realized before. One of the senders, with whom I'd had a complicated relationship right up until her death a couple of years ago, that sender wasn't much given to letting me know that she loved me. Well, there was one time I remember well, a few months before she died, but that was bound up in a package that included enough other feelings as to render it inadmissible as evidence. She never really said it. Not as far as I can remember. And over time, I've come to understand why it might have been quite so hard for her to do so. She couldn't say it, but she could write it. Over and over again, on birthday cards, dog-eared airmail letters, and postcards filled with her impossibly tiny, spidery handwriting. All my love, with lots of love, with love from your ma. It was enough. As I closed the last box, I remembered very clearly the last words I'd said to her. They weren't written down anywhere, but I won't ever forget them. I leant down, touched her face, and said, I love you, Ma.
On my second day of work in my first job, I tipped a large Bewley's cappuccino all over my desk. Work wasn't busy, so I'd ventured out to get a coffee from Grafton Street. There were other places much nearer, but Bewley's coffee tasted the best. Anyway, the cup upturned itself and the splash resounded through the open plan office, and the coffee flooded my books and papers and went inside every letter of the keyboard and all over the fluffy carpet where it sat in a lake of foam. I never thought I'd look nostalgically on that moment until Bewley's announced the closure of its last surviving Grafton Street Oriental Cafe, and I recall how much I needed that coffee. Once I'd found some carpet cleaner and got on my hands and knees, I walked back up the street and got another coffee. They gave it to me for free. I kept going to Bewley's every day as I had done through college, even once getting my dad to drive me there through rush hour traffic on his way to work. Do you mean to tell me I'm driving you here so you can get a premium coffee? He said. There was something about being allowed freely enter a building with such high ceilings, a former school where the likes of Robert Emmet and Oscar Wilde were taught. The branch run by the famous Quaker Bewley family first opened in 1927 on Grafton Street, Dublin's main boulevard of chance and converse, according to the late poet Anthony Cronin. A regular, Brendan Kennelly, described it as the heart and hearth of Dublin. It was the first place in the city you could get a good coffee. It was somewhere to be seen, an alternative networking space to the more hazardous, male-dominated pub. A lot of what Bewley's came to mean was the stories other people told you, of characters who collected there, from the lady in shabby furs who sat there all day to the table of Jewish men chatting in Yiddish, all presided over by a head waitress named Tattens, who came to work there with her twin sister Bridie in 1948 when they were 16, and they both stayed their whole working lives. Brendan Behan, the drinker with the writing problem, ate his lunch there. Mary Lavin wrote there for hours with her baby daughter sleeping beside her. Maeve Binchy hung out there as a student in the late 50s, debating the issues of the day, and later corrected her pupils' work there, drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes. Years later, she wrote that even when she didn't have the chance to go in, she would stand at the window to inhale the aroma of coffee, the amazing sight of beans jumping, being ground just for our pleasure, she wrote. The three-tiered stand of almond buns and cherried buns and eclairs and opera cake they used to put on each table. You paid for the cakes after you'd eaten them, and my mother used to talk about her anxiety watching her young son's greedy arm reaching out again and again for more cakes they hadn't yet paid for. In the 80s and 90s, you went there to sober up with friends over hot chocolate or chips, talking late into the night. In the afternoons, there were elderly women who sat for hours making the most of a teabag. Students, politicians, bankers, bohemians, nuns. And onto the street, an important extension of Bewley's, maybe the hothouse flowers busking, or the very tall Pete Short selling Hot Press magazine, and a Trinity graduate called Christopher Daybell, who would come into the cafe with handmade books of his poetry photocopied and stapled together, and say, "Anyone for poetry?" Bewley's was so beloved of the people that when the cafes ran into serious difficulties in the mid-1980s, Garrett Fitzgerald was persuaded by his wife Joan to attempt to nationalise them, leading to the nickname "On Board Bun." One writer who sat there through the 80s, Patrick Healy, told me you never made arrangements because you knew you'd run into somebody, pre-mobile phones, and then you ran into everybody. There was no age bar or social bar in this Dubliner's mecca. My early memories of Bewley's are of standing ravenous in the long cramped queues and how the waitresses in their black dresses and aprons looked like girls in photographs from another century. When my best friend and I took to bunking off school, we would drift into Bewley's and hide at the back with a plate of breakfast until the day was over. And for some reason, we were never asked questions by the matriarchal women who came to top up our tea. It's not that Bewley's still did the best coffee in Ireland. It's that it's a national treasure, or an heirloom. It's a place that gave us all something in common, a place that kept us in contact with people who have gone. It's a place I've had two almost completely silent meetings, where I had the least enjoyable lunch ever in the best seats next to the Harry Clark windows, when my two-year-old kicked up and our sophisticated outing ended with me picking smashed glass from his hands, a waiter standing by with a first aid kit. But it's curtains for Bewley's once more, and its cafe theatre is out on its own again. This leaves something of a hole in the city. In a way, Bewley's is Grafton Street. They're the same thing. In a way, Bewley's is Dublin. Same thing. And in a way, it's ours.
I've been north and I've been south and I've been east and west. I've been just a rolling stone. Yet there's one place on this earth I've always liked the best. Just a little town I call my own. But Dublin can be heaven with coffee at 11 and a stroll.
It is early April 2020, and the nursing home lets us know that my mother, who has lived with Alzheimer's for many years, is dying. Panicked, my husband and 14-year-old daughter and I bundle ourselves into our car and speed from the city centre out to the quiet suburb where my mother is. Miraculously, no guards stop us. The nursing home is in lockdown, but has compassionately allowed my father inside to be with his wife. There, masked, gowned and gloved, he sits and tells her stories of their first meeting, of their life together of 60 years. There, he tells her that he loves her. When I arrive that afternoon, I see my father trundling back up the garden path from the nursing home, my brother and sister in tow, both looking afraid to touch him due to the virus, but their hands nevertheless nearing towards his arm to support him. Though the sun beats down, I feel I am watching my father as a strange apparition of King Lear heading out, distraught, onto the troubled heath, thunderclouds gathering. We stand in a devastated circle, 2 metres apart, on a patch of sunlit grass, and are silenced by our separation from each other and the dying woman we love. Then an idea comes to me. Let's find the window. I'm not sure. My brother is hesitant. But I am 9 years old again, high on adventure stories, and I head for the garden gate, pleased to see that he is following, my sister remaining with our dad. We are careful, the two of us, use tissues to key in the code, and then we find ourselves in the garden. I have come from the city, where greenery is hard to access. But here, white cabbage butterflies flit through the air. The garden is profuse with the colour of flowers and squirrels freely darting up tree trunks. If I wasn't on such a tragic mission, I would think we'd entered happiness, where viruses and illness did not exist. But which window? They've moved my mother, and it is hard to know where to find her. Is it the fourth window down? I scramble my way through bushes, half tripping over a garden hose that is tangled there like an ominous snake. Undeterred, I peer inside. The sun is so strong, I have to make a screen with my hand and wait until reflections in the glass steady. And there she is, lying sideways, face towards the window, as though waiting for us. Her familiar engagement ring and gold wedding band, elegant on her long fingers, her gentle face still beautiful to me. The cold of the window grows warmer as I press my fingers into it, wishing only to feel the fading heat of her hand. I call out words of love to her, and the kind masked carer, taking pity, pushes the bed closer, closer, but there is no response from Mum. My mother doesn't die for another 7 days. I make one more trip to the window that week with my daughter, and this time Mum makes tiny gestures. The carer leans in and reveals she whispered, "Big kiss." We feel elated that the last two words directed at us are of enduring love. Easter Saturday comes. It is a day of sunshine again, of peace in the garden. Half an hour before my mother dies, the same carer, whose face I can never forget, comes masked and gloved across the lawn, carrying a tray of tea and cake and ice cream for my family. It's as though we are children again, and my mother has wished a sunny picnic for us all. Then comes my father, tripping weak-legged into sight, the news of her death on his face. And all restrictions forgotten, my sister and I race into his arms, race into the near future of her funeral day, where 10 of us gather in a church a meter apart, and where later we throw branches of cherry blossoms into her grave and play and sing her favourite songs. Shawadi Wadi's, "Let's go for a little walk." Simon and Garfunkel's, "Are you going to Scarborough Fair?" And as we all head home at noon, that day of her funeral, to our separate homes, a sudden image comes to me of the window in the nursing home. And I realise that I can feel no anger towards it and the strange and awful circumstances we find ourselves in, only relief that this window has offered us all a final closeness to our mother before her long fingers and her gentle face stilled forever and before the dark curtains were finally drawn.
On this morning's programme, we heard "Hold Me Now, Johnny" by Sinead Inglesby, "Desert Song" by Rosalind D, "Shoeboxes" by Connor Horgan, "Anyone for Poetry" by Maggie Armstrong, and "Through the Window" by Enda Wiley. This morning's music began with "Hold Me Now" by Johnny Logan, sung live at the 1987 Eurovision Song Contest in Brussels, with commentary from Terry Wogan. After that, we heard "Caravan" by Duke Ellington and his orchestra, featuring Juan Tizol on valve trombone. Then we heard "October" by U2. And finally, "The Dublin Saunter" by Noel Purcell. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey. The producer is Sarah Binchy.
RTE Radio 1.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.